Toxic people think you're holding a grudge when you're actually just holding a boundary. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I'm an adult child of a dysfunctional family, which I realized after dating two alcoholics named Brian back to back. If you've not heard that story, you need to go listen to my very first episode. It is required listening around here. So welcome aboard this hot mess of a ship. We curse here, you've been warned. So today, folks, we are diving deep with Dr. Peter Salerno. He is a psychologist who specializes in personality disorders, and he is the author of several books, but his two most recent books are the ones that we are discussing in this conversation. Number one, The Nature and Nurture of Narcissism, Understanding Narcissistic Personality Disorder from the Perspective of Gene-Environment Interaction. And two, Cruelty by Nature, The Science of Intentional Abuse Rooted in Biology. And so the overall premise of both of these books and what makes Peter stand out in the field of personality disorders is his theory in what causes them. So he does not believe that childhood trauma causes personality disorders, but rather it is driven by biological and trait-based factors. And while he does believe that childhood trauma can play a role, it can be a factor, he also believes that someone could develop a personality disorder without experiencing any sort of childhood trauma. So like somebody could grow up in a completely healthy and loving home and still develop a personality disorder. And so you're going to hear me push back on him some. And I just want to share what was coming up for me in this conversation and what was coming up for me in the preparation for this conversation and going through his books and trying to understand his position. And my issue really isn't in the position itself, that personality disorders are not solely caused by childhood trauma. Now, I'm not an expert on narcissistic personality disorders or personality disorders at large. I will say, from what I do know, I do tend to think that there is absolutely a trauma component always at play, but I'm not necessarily sold on it being, you know, solely trauma-based. It definitely does appear that it's both nature and nurture. He lays out pretty solid scientific evidence in his books that clearly shows that there is a biological component here. My issue is the way in which childhood trauma is defined and addressed in the book. What he is describing as childhood trauma is actually only the big T overt kind. Trauma that's episodic and event-driven. And the symptoms that he links are general PTSD symptoms, not complex PTSD symptoms. And so that feels like a key gap for me. Because when we're talking about whether or not childhood trauma contributes to personality disorders, we typically are not just focusing on big T overt trauma. We're talking about complex relational trauma, the chronic, subtle shit that happens repeatedly over time, stuff that a lot of people don't realize is actually even trauma. That is the type of trauma that really can shape personality development. And so there's something that just feels really off to me in presenting a theory that childhood trauma isn't a cause of personality disorders when the definition of trauma being used is so narrow. And so I got to be honest, I was I was pretty triggered by this and honestly surprised at how much. I think at the root of it is it felt invalidating to the kind of trauma that so many of us have actually lived. The type of trauma that doesn't fit neatly into those narrow boxes. You know, as someone who spent years thinking that my childhood was just, you know, not great, but not realizing that it was actually trauma and struggling in romantic relationships for years and years and years without understanding that the root cause of it was my childhood trauma. If I read this book back then, I would have walked away thinking, no, I didn't experience childhood trauma because of how narrowly it's defined in these books. So it just feels dismissive of how deeply these subtle, complex relational traumas can impact us and just how much they shape our personalities. I mean, folks, like our entire personalities can basically be trauma responses, right? And as we know, there's just so many people out there who still don't realize that the struggles that they're facing are rooted in complex trauma. And so many of us have sat in therapist's office for years and years and years without them identifying that what we were suffering from was CPTSD, because on the surface, maybe our childhoods didn't seem, you know, quote unquote, that bad. And so my concern isn't so much in whether someone with NPD misses their trauma, but that people who keep landing in relationships with narcissists won't understand that the reason they're drawn there is their own childhood trauma. And so we actually recorded this over two separate occasions. And so in the last half an hour, that's our second sit down, after I had a chance to read his most recent book, or read some of it, which is the Cruelty by Nature. And so you'll hear me bring up a section where he discusses complex PTSD versus borderline personality disorder. And while the section is titled just that, CPTSD and borderline, once again, what is defined as complex PTSD is actually describing standard PTSD. And so again, what really triggered me here is that misdiagnosis is rampant. People get labeled borderline when it's actually CPTSD. And actually just recently, you know, a friend of mine was in that exact situation. He was told he had borderline, and after seeking other opinions, it was confirmed that he didn't. He had CPTSD. And so it just feels reckless to define CPTSD inaccurately. It feels reckless to define CPTSD and then describe PTSD, because this has real consequences, folks. So I'll get off my soapbox now. I can't wait to hear what y'all think about this episode. Let a gal know. But first, let's talk about what you, yes, you need to Dan the Doing Shit Show, my online support community, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups, where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket. You, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, the one who just felt a little punch to the gut when I said that, a little, I don't know, a little tingling in your heart area, or maybe you flinched a little bit. Yeah, I'm talking to you, okay? Let's do the damn thing already. See the link in the show notes. You can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. If you don't know how to find the show notes, I actually just had somebody send me an email and say, I don't know what you mean when you say, what the show notes, how the hell do I find the show notes? If you don't know how to find the show notes, you can send me an email at Andrea@adultchildpodcast.com. And I will explain to you how to find the show notes. So let's do it already. Okay. For less than $1 a day, hop on this damn healing ship. Next, give me a follow on Insta, on TikTok, @AdultChildPod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. Dr. Peter Salerno, author of what I wanted to talk about, The Nature and Nurture of Narcissism, but your most recent book is going to say Naughty by Nature.
Cruelty by Nature. Naughty by Nature fits.
Yes. Yes. Very true. So typically where I start is asking, when did you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought? You left me hanging, wanting to know more when you talk about coming to terms with narcissism and the realization with your grandmother. So I was hoping that you could kind of speak to that more.
Yeah.
When you were in school, was it a brand new epiphany of like being in school and realizing that, or had you had some suspicions?
No suspicions, because I guess to answer your question about childhood, my parents didn't traumatize me, but they were, I was exposed to trauma from, you know, like obviously the story that I share in my book about my maternal grandmother. I spent a great deal of time with her growing up, because my mother, we lived very like a mile away from my grandmother's house, and my mother always, her entire life, tried to connect with her mom. So I was always brought over there as a kid, and then my grandmother would do this pretty horrendous stuff, and then I would be subjected to that. But my own mom always conceptualized it as, well, my mom, you know, my grandmother, my mom just had she had a really hard life. She had a really hard life. That was her justification for every time her mother would abuse her. She had a really hard life. She had a really hard life. So I just thought, well, can people who have hard lives, you know, act this way? And she's not mistreating my mom. She just had a hard life, right? When I started to see the descriptions of pathology in grad school, and it was like unfolding to me, like before my eyes, that this my maternal grandmother fit the bill for all this, these features. That's when I was really like, okay, I need to maybe go back and look at my own experiences of witnessing this and see what it was all about. So it wasn't necessarily like an epiphany, so much more as like a study. I was just like, a lot of things probably make sense now that I have words and descriptions to explain it. And then I kind of did that with all of the relationships in my life, friendships, romantic relationships, things like that. So it kind of turned into this investigative discovery for myself, because of that. But it's interesting because if I had not pivoted, I started in a grad program for literature, English literature, like
Oh,
liberal arts
interesting.
degree. Yeah. And if I hadn't pivoted to psychology, I don't have any idea where I would be or how I would have made sense of that whole thing. I probably would have kept saying till today when people asked, oh, yeah, my grandmother had a really hard life. She had a really hard life.
What prompted the switch to psychology?
So interestingly, in my literature program, we were asked to choose a critical theory to analyze some fiction, and what I chose psychoanalytic theory to analyze a Shakespeare play, and then I got fascinated with psychology, and then I also had just come out of a really traumatic and difficult relationship and breakup that I landed me in therapy. And so I started getting curious about therapy because I liked what my therapist was saying. And I'm like, wow, so people do this like for like a living and on purpose. And it was interesting to me. So I said,
People do
you
this on purpose for a living.
know, so I just kind of said, I'll apply to a few programs. If I get in, I'll start over, and if not, whatever. And I ended up getting accepted to one of my programs that I really wanted to go to, and that's pretty much it. But even when I got accepted into my grad psych program, I thought I was going to teach psychology. I never thought I was going to do therapy. It was just not, that wasn't something I had ever conceptualized. I thought I was going to teach and do research, and I ended up going the route of becoming a therapist. And so, but now I'm more actually dedicated to research and teaching. So, yeah.
So when you, what did your mom have siblings?
Yeah, she had a younger sister and a younger brother.
And so what were like the dynamics there? How were they treated? Like it seems like your mom was like the designated scapegoat.
Yeah. So my uncle, who's amazing, I love my uncle. He was like the golden child, but he doesn't act like one. He's not narcissistic or anything. He just was treated like he was. She my grandmother favored boys, so he was just treated better, not great, but better. And then my aunt, she actually recently spoke to me and said, "I don't think I remember my childhood the way your mother remembers it. I don't remember it being as bad as she got it." I remember, there was some kind of criticism conflated with, mixed in with some, nurture. So it doesn't, I don't remember things the way she did. And I kind of explained to her how that's possible. You can come from the same parent and have a very different experience of your life.
That's
But
really
my mom
interesting.
definitely got the brunt of it. My uncle, surprisingly, he actually said, I stopped even listening or taking my mother seriously when I was 13, because even though I wasn't getting abused the way your mother was, I knew she was full of it. And so I just kind of started differentiating and individuating as a teenager because I knew she wasn't good for me. So.
What was I going to ask? And so then when you started learning about all of this, what did conversations look like with your mom?
Challenging because my mom had the hardest time accepting that my grandmother was abusive. So, and I mean, I think I mentioned a lot of the abuse in the book, but I mean, we're talking about, cutting her with knives, throwing things at her, breaking things over her head, grabbing her by the hair, dragging her around the house, calling her horrible names, unwarranted names that didn't fit her personality at all, but just really terrible names to call your daughter. But my mom to this day will say, I just want to know why. I think it was because she had a really hard life. It's very hard for her to understand the intentionality of it. How I understand the intentionality of it is it came completely unprovoked. There wasn't, it's not like my mom was giving her a hard time and she reacted. It was being volunteered. The abuse and the threats and the criticism and the devaluation was being volunteered. It was just sort of, she just decided, okay, now is the time to start devaluing and saying harsh things and doing harsh things. So I think that's hard for my mom to reconcile, is that like, why, what, if my mom was doing this intentionally, why? Like, what did I do? And I tell her to this day, that's the wrong question to ask. You're never going to get a satisfying answer to why.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there's an aspect to it that is, as a kid,
mm-hmm.
It's so much easier for a child to believe that it's because of them, right? Like, yes, it's their fault in some way, because to think that our caregiver, the person that's responsible for keeping you alive, you know, right, to think that they're the problem is really scary. And I think that when that is so deeply, deeply ingrained in you, even though your mom isn't consciously thinking that now, you know,
right,
but that is so deeply wired in.
So, you know, it's children would prefer to be a bad kid or like a bad object in a good world with good parents than to be a good kid with bad parents in a bad world. And so I think immediately it's, you know, children who have the capacity for empathy, children who are affected by this type of abuse, parental abuse, they would err on the side of, it's probably more convenient for it to be something I did wrong than it to be that my parent is wrong. And I don't even think that needs to get taught. I think a lot of kids inherently prefer that. And so they self-blame early on.
It's a sense of control too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm thinking about it with a friend of mine, which he's finally coming to see as like a rather toxic relationship. And just the tendency for her to go to a place of like, you know, it's, I'm the problem. It's my fault. I mean, a lot of that stems from childhood stuff, but mm-hmm. so much of it stems from a sense of control, because if I'm the problem, then maybe I can fix it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, cause what are you going to do if it's someone else that you depend on, mm-hmm. and you can't fix that. Right. So I think that control is, you know, it's a defense. It's a coping strategy that I think is resourceful in some ways, but you can take it to an extreme.
Yeah. It can kill you.
Yeah.
Slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to hear about like, what was the process in coming to terms with your theories of, and I don't know, would you, I know that you don't say you think it's all nature, but
no,
primarily nature, but I'd just be curious as far as like, what did that journey look like for you?
Yeah. That's a great question.
And why did you become so passionate about it?
Yeah, that's also a great question. So I never thought I would care about nature or genetics or anything. I was in degree programs that taught me that everything is, for the most part, environmentally determined. And I appreciated that. I liked that, you know. And I think even that's an element of control, if we're talking about control, because if it's environmentally determined, then you can use an environment to change that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of control and freedom there to a large degree. I think what I started seeing is in my clinical practice, I started seeing a lot of exceptions to this rule that people were just defending themselves against pain. There were a lot of people who in moments of clarity were admitting to me for one reason or another that they were doing a lot of things on purpose to people to harm them. and that they didn't have any empathy or any remorse about it. And then actually, they saw it more as a social strategy and a reward than a defense mechanism. And so, if we're going to believe the people who say that they act out because or react because they're traumatized, we also have to leave room for the possibility that there's people who are telling us the truth when they say they're not traumatized, they're just benefiting from being this way. So I
Was
didn't
there a
really.
particular client that really stood out to you in that respect? Is there a
I mean,
memorable?
there were several. There were several. I mean, I worked. I remember. Because when you become a therapist, you have to do 3,000 hours of clinical work under supervision, and that's sort of like your residency, if you will. And so you go in different settings. I worked in different clinical settings where I was facilitating groups where lots of people were trying to one up each other on the harm and malice they caused, and they were having a great time sharing these stories.
What kind of groups were these?
I mean, groups in like dual diagnosis treatment centers where people were going there for, drug and alcohol abuse or some other kind of mental condition or disorder. But the groups would sort of turn into like people like sharing stories of, their debauchery, if you will. I mean, and I'm not talking about like drug use. I'm talking about they were sharing stories of like murder and things like that, and just not having really much of a conscience about the things that they said that they did to do what they had to do to get what they wanted. And it was sort of like, oh, really, that's nothing. And someone else would say, look, listen to what I did. And I
Are these like
was
in the prison system?
some of them were mandated, and then some of them were just in like like inpatient treatment centers and things like that.
Yeah, I've been to rehab like 4 or 5 times. I've been sober for 17 years. I've just never heard anybody like
Oh,
swapping
wow.
murder stories before in any of the treatment centers that I've been in.
Depends on the facility. 'cause I worked in some facilities where there was mandated. It was mandated. It was either you go to jail or you go to rehab or treatment. And so those types of settings, which can be very valuable and useful for some people who want to rehabilitate. I'm not knocking the system. I'm just saying
Oh
that
no, I was
some,
just surprised to hear that was
yeah,
like a common
some
thing
people,
of people swapping murder stories.
yeah, who. Some people trickle in who are really like, not really wanting to be there. They're just kind of using it as an opportunity to, whatever. So I started kind of collecting those
Data
stories and just kind
points.
of wondering, yeah, using them as data points. And then, but then obviously in my personal life, I was in multiple relationships that I couldn't understand why it wasn't working. I couldn't understand why it wasn't. And I'm not saying I was a saint and perfect in these relationships, but the difficulties seemed to be different than just your kind of run-of-the-mill typical co relational conflicts that people have that they work out. They weren't being worked out, and I was trying everything to work them out, and I was trying, to collaborate. And the more I collaborated, and the more I empathized, and the more I used my trauma theories to understand the person behaving in certain ways, the worse it would get. And so I started, going down this rabbit hole of like, what is this? What do we even call this? I mean, you don't get it. You don't really get a lot of it in psychology degree programs, graduate psych programs. You really don't hear about. I mean, you hear you get like a personality theory course and an abnormal psych course, and then but they don't really go into the detail of what it looks like to interact with somebody who is, pathologically narcissistic or whatever the case may be. You know the terms, but they don't tell you, what to look for or, really. So I started kind of doing my own investigative research and using continuing education to my dogs and cats might join us too.
This is
Hi,
Tucker.
Kitty. Hi, Tucker. So I started taking some continuing education for my license and, geared towards manipulative behaviors and things like that. And the literature's out there. I just didn't know it existed. I always thought if anyone was misbehaving, it was because they were traumatized. They were abused, and they're just reenacting that in current relationships. And it took a long time for me to wrap my head around the possibility that there was an alternative perspective that was legitimate. So it was hard for me to stretch my imagination in that way and look at data that didn't agree with what I was taught. And, you know, I spent a great deal of money and time and investment in believing. So it was hard. It was a hard transition for me to start investigating intentionality of abuse. And yeah, certainly there's narcissists and thing and people like who behave in ways, and it is because they're compensating for low self-esteem. That's true. There's also a great deal of people who aren't compensating for anything, and they're harming people, and they don't care that they're harming people. And that was very difficult for me to accept. I had to accept it in my personal life and professional life. And so the book is a result of that journey. You know, I'm currently working on an updated and revised edition of it. And
of your most recent book?
No, of The Nature and Nurture of Narcissism. Because I don't want people to think, first of all, that I think that even when I use the term nature, I'm not saying that it's everything is determined by nature. I'm saying that if you look at things from an evolutionary perspective, there are some pretty, there are some traits that are inappropriate for personal relationships that may have served us for survival a long time ago, and they didn't die out. People still have them, you know, and those traits are entitlement, callousness, hostility, manipulativeness, deception, you know, things that kept us alive as a species, I think served a purpose at one point. But in the society we're trying to create, where we're trying to be collaborative and cooperative and nice, those don't fit, but people still have them. And the people who have them at the extreme level, it's not necessarily because they were traumatized in childhood. It's because they inherited them through human DNA. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that it's even that we need to throw the environmental baby out with the bathwater. That's not what I'm saying. I get accused of that a lot, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying we need to introduce this possibility that some of these traits are innate in some people, and they're not better explained by adversity, you know?
Yeah, the one thing, a couple of things was like, one is, and maybe it's just was how I was reading it, but mm-hmm. I almost felt like your argument was being made from the premise of like that there are a lot of people out there that are claiming that it's just nurture. And like when it comes to NPD, and I don't really feel like I hear that anywhere where people are just solely claiming it's based off nurture. I feel like most of what I hear is people speaking to it being a combination of both. But are there many theories out there that are truly pushing just solely nurture?
Yes. Yeah, there are. Yeah. Especially okay. especially in psychological literature, there's a lot of inflation of environment and kind of sweeping under the rug that there's anything related to biology.
Okay. I mean, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is there a theory that is, I mean, I have issues with the DSM, and I just wonder how much are things just not updated, and how much of it is driven by money and so many different things, but what would be the politically correct, most accepted theory of what would cause, well, are they, I had heard recently that they, are they going to be going towards more of personality disorders being more on a spectrum?
Yeah. I mean, well, they already have, you're asking great questions. They already have created what's called the alternative model of personality disorders and personality in general, which is like, we're not going to put people in a category and say, okay, you check 5 boxes, you're a narcissist. You check 5 boxes, you're a psychopath. We're going to now look at like autism, and even now schizophrenia is on a continuum or spectrum, where it's not that some people are schizophrenic and some people aren't. It's that some people have very mild, you know, psychotic mm-hmm. features, to moderate, to severe, to extreme. And we're going to do that now with narcissism. There's people who have mild narcissistic traits where it doesn't necessarily interfere in their life and others in a way that's like, you need therapy. And then there's people on the moderate, and then there's people on the severe, and then there's people on the extreme, where like it's causing significant impairment in not only in their life, but in the lives of others. Like if you're in their orbit, you're going to be hurt. And so now we're kind of looking at this trait-based model where, mm-hmm. yeah, environment matters, but also there's some inherent traits in some people that are just a bit more severe than in other people. And so I think a great theory would be you have some people that are more, have a more vulnerable temperament and trait profile, that if the, if environmental circumstances are not favorable, it can really set them on a trajectory to be really narcissistic. Mm-hmm. And so it's always both. It's never either or. It's always, it's nature and nurture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually surprised to hear that you've encountered a lot of people saying that it's probably a combination, because most of the pushback I get is that this is a relational disorder, and that if the relationship is good enough, you can prevent narcissism, but if it's not good enough, you're going to foster it. Whereas I see that as even a good enough nurturing environment, some children have a temperament, well, they will reject that nurture and exploit it because of this innate trait profile that they have. So I think it's always both.
I mean, I think that, I mean, I do view it largely as relational, but I would be, I mean, it'd be wrong of me to dismiss that there is not some sort of a genetic component like to it. And I think there's so many different factors that play into it. So just so you know, like I realized when I was at 9 years of sobriety is when I came to terms with what I was experiencing in romantic relationships was complex PTSD. So I just kept finding myself in one toxic relationship after the next. And what I didn't realize was that as soon as I got into a relationship and my abandonment wound was triggered, I was living in a trauma response. And I had always known that my childhood was less than ideal. I had never considered what I went through, like during my childhood, as trauma, because I thought that trauma was, had to be, you know, big T stuff. And so I mean, I had no idea like how much my childhood had truly impacted me. And so I don't consider my parents narcissists. I don't consider myself to be an expert on the topic. I have a lot of people in my community that grew up in narcissistic households. So my issue in reading the book isn't really in the nature versus nurture, but more so in, I felt like you were trying to downplay like the role of complex and relational trauma. But then when you were speaking to things, you were speaking to it very much through the lens of big T shock trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So there were just like certain things, like I felt like you were like in the ways in which you were trying to disprove like relational trauma having as big of an impact, making comments or statements referring to it as like event driven or episodic. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think it was you were speaking to trauma being treated effectively through like exposure therapy or like cognitive therapy. And like, yeah, that would be effective in treating big T trauma, but not necessarily through like complex or relational trauma. So for me, it's not so much in even with the narcissist aspect of it, but more so in kind of downplaying the role that complex and relational trauma does play in shaping our personality traits.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, so in the context of the book, I am speaking specifically about trauma as being the causative factor or the agent that creates narcissism. So when I'm talking about complex trauma or, you know, big T, little T trauma, event trauma, what I'm trying to say is there are narcissists who do exist who don't come from adversity. So we can't try to complicate it and throw like a complex label on it or say that because they had complex trauma that they became narcissistic, when there is research to show that that's not necessary. It's a risk factor, but it's not a causative factor. That's really the full argument for me. I don't intend to downplay little T trauma or complex PTSD or relational trauma as not being significant. What I'm saying is the way that we understand narcissism has been solely, for the most part, attributed to relational trauma, that object relations, right? We're talking about like Kernberg and all of these theories, Kohut, that if a child has a good enough environment, that can prevent them from being narcissistic, right? And what I'm trying to say is, adversity or not, there are people who are going to be narcissistic regardless of their parental environment, their nurturing environment. So, but I appreciate that feedback. And if it sounded like I was downplaying trauma generally, then, you know, that's definitely something that needs to be revised. I was just trying to make the point that there are human beings who exist who came from stable family upbringings without adversity and still meet the full criteria for NPD.
I'm going to point out another example. I was listening to an interview with you and you were speaking about a client of yours that I think it was he a first responder.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what you were stating, I don't know what specific type of therapy, I think maybe you did EMDR with him to work through his PTSD symptoms, but that the narcissistic traits were still there. And then therefore, like using that as a reason to say that like trauma couldn't be causing like his narcissistic traits. But again, that's looking at one big T trauma, shock T trauma that's happened in adulthood and not necessarily the childhood stuff. I guess also it's too in framing. I think about it from the perspective of people who have trauma responses that come across as narcissistic.
Yeah.
You know? And so yeah. I think that you have to be kind of like careful in that it almost comes across as like invalidating in a way of like when you're referring to like trauma symptoms as being like flashbacks and emotional numbing, and then referring to the remaining traits of the narcissism as being like narcissistic traits when there are trauma responses that look like narcissistic traits.
Yeah, I know the interview that you're referring to. I'm glad you're bringing it up. So in that case, with that individual, I was trying to highlight the reality that when the adversity from the, you know, big T single event trauma dissipated, what started to unveil itself or reveal itself in the treatment was that this person wasn't interested in collaborating with me to heal. What they wanted to do is they wanted to get me to corroborate and co-sign their abusive behavior toward others. And I didn't go into it fully there, but I do remember saying in that interview, it can be argued that there's more trauma there that's, you know, unconscious even to that person. Mm-hmm. And so that could be the counter argument that maybe what I was experiencing from that person could be trauma that's unconscious. But there's really no way for me to verify that. And even if there was, the treatment in a case like that would not actually be to figure that out in every case. It would mm-hmm. sometimes be to just to correct and manage the behavior, because the behaviors were pretty malignant that he was saying that he was considering doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm hearing you. I don't want to give people the impression that I'm invalidating that even trauma and reactions.
And I hope you know too, this is just like healthy, like back and forth. I hope I'm not like, you know, I love this. I love having this kind of conversation.
I'm so excited that you're saying
me too.
Yeah. No. I'm not. I love this because this is the things that a lot of people, I would say, accuse me of without verifying, and you're mm-hmm. verifying. And I love that. I love an opportunity to speak to this.
Oh, good. I love having conversations like this.
So. Are there first of all, are there narcissistic traits in non-narcissists? Yes.
I would love for you to speak to like the overuse of narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say much more often when out in society, when people are referring to other people as narcissists, it's probably not accurate. And it yeah. probably is speaking to either one, the person has narcissistic traits, or two, I think it also has served as a way to deflect and not take accountability
100%,
for ourselves.
100%. And just for the record, because I think a lot of people get this wrong about me, when I talk about like the, even like the psychoanalytic and theories that the developmental theories that are related to like how someone is treated in crucial developmental stages of life, can that create a narcissistic personality organization that's different from NPD? Like, so we're not calling them like an NPD narcissist, but they have these defensive strategies that make them seem very narcissistic that almost superficially look identical to NPD. Is that possible? 100%. 100%. Can trauma make people react in ways where they dissociate from their behaviors and they cope in ways that are maladaptive, even though they're a good person? And can that be mistaken for narcissism? Yeah, absolutely. What all I was really trying to do with that book is say there's this major element that has been intentionally, and I can prove it's been intentionally, swept under the rug in psychological literature, that nature matters nothing, that we are born blank slates, and parents and caregivers and teachers and siblings and society and culture can write upon us whatever they want us to be, and we will become that, and we have no agency. This is a very like persistent theme in psychological literature, that environment determines everything, that you don't have any free agency whatsoever. So you're either blessed with people who are good enough to treat you with autonomy, or you're not. And then for the rest of your life, that's your trajectory. I don't agree with that. I think even as children, we have minds of our own. That doesn't mean we're in control of every choice we make, but we do have minds of our own. We're active agents in our relationships, even with our peers. We're not solely like designed and engineered from the ground up by adversity. That's all I was really trying to say. And you know, the good news is I want people like you to speak to me so that I start thinking about how I can word things better in the future.
Well, I think that that would be so helpful in rewriting the book to definitely have something that really does speak to the way in which relational and developmental trauma can influence our personality. And also, too, and how much of it can show up sometimes in narcissistic traits.
Well, traits, yeah. But I mean, yes. Yeah. But I'm not talking about people with trauma responses. I'm talking about people who intentionally harm others because of their narcissism is pretty flagrant, pretty malignant. I'm speaking in the context of narcissistic individuals who are predisposed to have a trait profile that's going to dictate how they select environments and modify them based on their traits. I'm talking about some individuals have more of a severity of those traits from the beginning. And those are the individuals that I'm really speaking of. I'm not speaking of
Most
every
severe.
human being, every child who has adversity. Now, again, I'm taking what you're saying and I'm liking it, because if I can improve upon the way I communicate that message, I'm absolutely going to, because that's the responsible thing to do. But what I don't want is to like conflate things that shouldn't be conflated. I don't want it to sound like I'm saying trauma doesn't matter at all. What I'm saying is there are some individuals, and they've done studies on brains, and they've done studies on individuals in even childhood who don't re even respond to what most kids would consider trauma in ways that traumatize them. They have sort of like an indifference to adversity. You
Would
know,
that be like sociopathic in a way?
Well, we call those callous, unemotional traits. So that, like, there's just some kid, and it's not even their fault. So I'm not saying they're bad kids. I don't use words like bad or evil. I don't even go there. I'm just talking about from an evolutionary perspective. Like some individuals have a trait profile that makes them less vulnerable to trauma. The issue, though, is some of those traits do cross over into narcissism. So even when you said sociopathy, like, so even when we talk about psychopathy, there's some traits that are similar in malignant narcissists. You know, there's like a, it's like sort of like we talked about the continuum or the spectrum. There's like a threshold where malignant narcissism to psychopathy isn't a giant leap. It's kind of like a little bit of a, just a step, in a lot for some people, right? So what I'm hearing you say based on your critique, which I value, is I want to be very clear in my next edition of my book that I'm talking about the more severe cases. I'm talking about not mild to moderate. I'm talking about severe to extreme cases of narcissism and NPD.
So would it be more malignant narcissists?
Well, I mean, it depends, because I also want to advocate for people who have been traumatized by narcissists. And so I don't want to say that only severe malignant narcissists traumatize others. There's mild to moderate narcissists that can be so indifferent to your feelings that they can really harm you. But this isn't related to addiction. This isn't related to trauma. This is related to people who are pretty much aware of what they're doing, and they just aren't caring enough to do anything about it, right?
Yeah, gosh. It is really hard for me to not believe that trauma isn't playing a role at all. It's really hard for me to not think that it's like showing up somehow, some way. I don't have the research for it though. Like, well, I'm just like telling you based off how I feel.
But, no, yeah. That's fair. That's fair. But does it show up? Does trauma show up in the same way in every individual? Like, did the trauma you suffered that you didn't know was trauma?
Of course, there's so many different factors that play into it.
And so we would want to know what those factors are. And
absolutely.
And, yeah.
Absolutely. I think what it is just like, it's so hard for me to believe, like, and I know it exists, and maybe it's just like, maybe I'm just like thinking about it, like more broadly speaking, but just that people can be just born that way biologically. It's just hard to grasp, like, you want to believe that people are born inherently good.
Well, first of all, I just want to say I was raised Catholic, Italian Catholic, you know, everybody is good in God's eyes. That's the narrative. And there's no such thing as bad. There's temptation that can make you behave badly, but everybody is inherently good. And then there's some people who disagree with that and say, no, we're born in sin. We're evil. Okay. I don't care about spiritual. I'm not talking about a spiritual argument right now. I'm just saying I come from the perspective that you're saying, where I gave everyone the benefit of the doubt and thought, if anyone's misbehaving, it's because they were mistreated. There's something wrong inherently, right? Brain imaging has shown that there are deficits in areas of the brain that are necessary to be what we have in a society determined to be good. And so when you have somebody who doesn't register to behave in the same ways that other people have decided is cooperative, collaborative, like, again, it's not their fault, but they are deviating from the norm that we've created.
The perspective of pedophilia. Like, at what part in history, not that long ago in history, of it not being considered what we consider it to be today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where it was socially acceptable to have young, you know, I'm thinking of Roman society, where it was very acceptable for nobility to have like young boys as like sex, you know, whatever you want to call it. And now today we call that abuse.
Exactly.
So a lot of this is social reality, right? And so when you mentioned the DSM earlier, what arguably the DSM can improve. And I'm not like a huge proponent of like, it's, I don't think it's the Bible. I say that in my book, it's not the Bible or the gospel truth. It's an evolving science. But what it tried to do is create a norm and then create what we would call deviations from the norm. And when we talk about personality disorders like narcissism, what we're saying is they're deviating from the norm enough that it's causing significant problems, not only for them, but for society and for other people. And so we would call that disorder. And some of that now can be accounted for by inherent wiring, temperament, the lottery of genetic makeup. Not to say that people have bad genes. There's no such thing as bad genes. But there are some, you know, genotypes that express themselves in ways where we've decided is not okay. And so we will call that pathology, or we will call that disorder. We could call it extreme difference if that's better. But I also want to be clear, when I talk about this stuff from a research perspective, it's a much different conversation than I'm having when I'm talking to somebody in clinical practice. I don't look at somebody who comes to me in clinical practice as a monster that I have to correct. I look at them as somebody who deserves integrity, decency, respect, and I treat them like I would treat anybody else, even if they mistreat other people. My job in a clinical setting isn't to judge them or say, hey, you're born bad. That's not language that would ever enter in that setting. But research can sound a bit harsher. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's a research that I've read recently on how two-year-olds can be extremely manipulative and callous. It's like, well, you hear that and you go, wait a minute, hold on. Like, we can't say that. I mean, they're just two. I don't look at it from the perspective of judgment so much as from the perspective of I have some traits that I could improve on myself. I don't attribute those traits strictly to the way I was brought up. So there's a responsibility in me that I need to work on that if it's interfering in my relationships. That's kind of how I see narcissism too.
So just like healing, learning isn't one size fits all. And if school wasn't exactly your happy place growing up and it's not your kids either, then you'll love knowing there's now a better way with Time for Learning. So Time for Learning is an online homeschooling platform that offers curriculum from pre-K all the way to 12th grade that gives families the flexibility to shape learning around real life. So let's say your family wants to do some traveling or your kid wants to participate in a hobby that doesn't fit into traditional school hours. This is schooling that you can do anywhere at any time. Or perhaps your kid only likes doing math on Mondays. You can set it up to where they only do one subject each day, or you can mix in different subjects each day. Plus, parents get tons of tools like activity planners and transcript templates that help keep everything organized. And they've been trusted by over 1 million students for over 20 years, y'all. So curious if Time for Learning is right for your family? Well, visit timeforlearning.com. That's time, the number four, learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms.
So I was supposed to interview this author, and I thought that her book was about adult children going no contact from their narcissistic parents.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I read the book, what got around to reading the book, it was about parents who are estranged from their adult children because their child's narcissistic partner or spouse has convinced the child that the parents are narcissists to go no contact. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm not saying that's not a thing. Like, I'm sure that exists, but not once in the book did it ever, because that sounds like some bullshit that a parent would say to avoid like accountability or looking at themselves. And so in the book, there wasn't a single part of like where the parent could analyze, maybe they're the narcissist. Or it was like, if your child all of a sudden starts saying to you, I'm revisiting my childhood differently. Basically, it was like all the things that we would say to our parents once we realized that we've experienced trauma during our childhood, this woman was using as reasons to prove that the partner has brainwashed and convinced the child that that the parent is a narcissist. So I told her, I said, ethically, I can't interview you. Like, this goes against everything that.
So I think correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm misinterpreting what you're saying. I think what you're looking for and what you're advocating for is when somebody has a point that they're trying to make, you also want the counter evidence that kind of level.
Yeah, but that's also damaging. Like, that's like not helpful to a parent, because like, I don't know if you've seen, like, there's a big market of people out there speaking to parents who kids who have cut off their parents because they refuse to take any sort of accountability.
Yeah.
These people speaking to them like, oh, your kid has been brainwashed. And so I'm not really comparing what you wrote to that.
I hear you.
Yeah. I was bringing it up from the standpoint of insane for these individuals where it is more of a biological thing. It's not like, oh, they can't just help it. Like, you're not trying to deflect blame off the narcissist at all. I think one of the things that maybe it triggers in me is, and this isn't you either, but I just see it so much in culture, are people who are constantly demonizing and labeling other people as narcissists to avoid looking at themselves and taking accountability.
I think that's an epidemic. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. In fact, I get a lot of, the other day I quoted something from a book, and I got in trouble from some people because I used the word struggle, because that's what the book said. I'm not gonna misquote the book. The book said narcissists struggle with identifying with the feelings and needs of others. A lot of people had problems with the word struggle. They don't struggle. They know what they're. It's like, well, first of all, you can interpret the word struggle to mean a lot of things. You know, I mean, you can struggle to lift something. That doesn't mean you're emotionally taxed, right? So But this idea of language, which I love that you're bringing up, is the wording is extremely important. The only problem that is, no matter how fair, square down the
Or
middle,
how you say it, somebody's gonna have a problem with it.
somebody's going to find a way to say that
100%.
you offended them or you hurt them or, you know. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have conversations like what you're bringing up. I love that you're not just taking everything at face value and you're saying, I don't know if I like this because it could, you know, mean this, or the implications here could mean that. I love that because that's how we learn and grow, you know. That's how we build character. So I love this conversation and it's going to give me a lot to think about. I don't want people to say your book is right and everything else is wrong, because that scares me, because that's a dichotomy too. That, like, well, why are you idealizing this book? You know, it could see, I mean, I love it when people say it's extremely helpful. I've never heard this perspective before. It gives me something to think about. But we don't want anyone to be in these all or nothing type of categories. So I really appreciated this conversation.
It is so interesting to think about it, how that is a part of me that got triggered in reading the book. And it's not what you're saying, but it is something that is so much in our culture, of just the demonizing and the labeling of others as a way to avoid taking accountability. But it's interesting that that's what gets stirred up in me.
Well, I think it gets stirred up because it's so prevalent. And so, you know, if you're researching the topic and reading books on that topic, it's easy to, you know, see glimpses of that, you know. But I agree with you. There's a lot of people scapegoating, and there's a lot of people externalizing blame and labeling people as things that are unfair. And I wish there was a way to prevent that, but I think that's just part of the, especially on social media. Social media is like a jungle, right? It's like you can't tame it. I think for me, something that made me, you asked me earlier, and I don't think I answered it, so I apologize, but you asked me what made me so passionate about this topic. I've experienced it myself as a client in therapy, but I've also encountered so many people who have been invalidated by the trauma narrative, where they're told the only reason this person did A, B, and C to you is because they're hurting. And even if there's a grain of truth to that, it sort of invalidates the experience of the person being abused. Like do let's say let we'll just go we'll just take it straight home. Let's say my maternal grandmother was suffering immensely inside. Should she have dragged my mother around by her hair and called her all these horrible names that didn't fit her? Or should she have tried to figure out why she feels compelled to do that? So if you just say, well, this person just had trauma, then almost what you're saying to a lot of victims or survivors is, well, just give them a break, because, you know, they wouldn't have done it if they would have been treated a little bit better. And sometimes there can be both. There can be an unconscious reaction. At the same time, there can almost be like a strategy to harm someone. Right. And so I'm trying to bridge a gap there, where there can be a space where there's pain mixed with some intentional harm that needs to stop.
Yeah, well, I guess it's kind of interesting. Because definitely around here, we're not talking like if, oh, you know, the person treated you that way because they had trauma. I mean, that's definitely not meant in any way to minimize, but more so to have an understanding. I think that it's hard for somebody to know. Let's say you're in a year-long relationship with somebody. I don't really know if somebody that's in a year-long relationship with somebody at the end of that is really in a place to say whether they know if that is somebody with narcissistic personality disorder that did also experience like things during their childhood or not, and does it really matter?
I agree with that. I agree with that. And I don't think it should be the business of people in personal relationships to try to figure that out. Are they, you know, but I think what you do need to do is if there are components that are more related to biological underpinnings, it will inform your expectations of if that year-long relationship should become a 10-year relationship. Because if the person is not, for whatever reason, whether they refuse to or they just are defending and so they're dissociating or denying, are they gonna change or are they gonna continue to treat you poorly? You need to know if this is an enduring, inflexible pattern or if it's something that you can go get sorted out. And unfortunately, human beings are not perfect specimens. We have alterations in the functioning that can make people not care as much about other people's feelings. And so if you're with someone like that, I think it's important to know whether or not that's going to change or if that's what you're, I think you have the right, almost like you have the right to know if that's the way the relationship's going to be and the person keeps insisting they're going to change, but they don't follow through with change. I think that you have a right to know if this is something that's highly inflexible versus.
Well, I think though that saying, even if something is rooted in trauma, that does not mean that it's something that is going to change or get better. I mean, I
Agreed.
would say the vast majority of people out there like don't heal and resolve
Yeah,
their
they're not
trauma and
seeking,
keep
they're not
acting in
seeking
that
to
way.
resolve it. Yeah.
So I think, from that standpoint, I don't think it's interesting if people are using the excuse. Yeah, it's different because it's when people are using it as an excuse of they have trauma to keep that person in their life and to remain being treated poorly. And I think that is a lot of maybe like where you're the standpoint that you're coming from.
I think causation is important to investigate because it, well, one, even for the person who's inflicting the harm, it informs how they can correct themselves. Because, again, like if it's not just rooted in trauma, you're gonna need other interventions to figure out, like what, like I mean, we've seen this theme in psychology in history where we used to blame schizophrenia on mothers. We called them the schizophrenogenic mother. They made their child psychotic. Well, now we know that there's a high genetic component to schizophrenia, right? So you treat it differently. Because if you keep treating it with relational therapy and you don't medicate schizophrenics, we have problems. And then we used to also treat autism as cold, unemotional parents created autism. Well, now we have we're able to look at from the moment of conception gene copy number variations that contribute to autism. So you don't want to treat it as a parental problem. If there's a genetic component, you need behavioral interventions, right? So a lot of this is to inform how to correct behavior in the person, afflicted with it. But then also, if you think you're going to love or empathize somebody who's malignant in their narcissism enough to change your you're going to waste your life doing so because there's other elements involved in that person's operating system that aren't going to be treated with love and affection. They're not going to be cured.
Well,
So
neither would trauma.
not well, some, what I'm trying to say is that a lot of people who have trauma without this malignant narcissism are much more willing to collaborate and cooperate to alleviate their symptoms, even if their symptoms are harmful to others. They're much more willing to look at it because they see it as something that they don't like in themselves. It's affecting them negatively.
But a lot of them don't want to look at it because of shame.
Well, but we can't call everyone who's shame avoidant narcissistic. And that's what a lot of people do. They've defined pathological narcissism as shame avoidance. And I say some, but not all. And many are not shameless, not shameful enough. And I have, there's literature to show this that the problem isn't that they're avoiding their shame. The problem is that they don't have that internal brake pedal that stops them from hurting people because they're not sh they can't get in touch with shame enough. But people argue, well, it's because they're avoiding the shame because it's too painful. Well, maybe in some, but not in all. And that's really what I was trying to argue.
What would suggest that it's not in all, like in those circumstances where it seems like there's no shame at all, what would argue against that's not just them presenting an image?
What would
What would, yeah, if they're showing that they have no shame, how do you really know what, like, deep down inside that's really valid or the case versus that's just what they're presenting to you?
Well, I guess I could answer that by saying, how do you know for sure that it is shame? Like, if, especially if it's unconscious, how can you prove that it's really shame as the root of this versus just a lack of, empathy or a lack of ability?
I guess you couldn't
to
prove either.
You can't really prove either, right? And so what I'm trying to say is, coming from, getting a master's and a doctorate in psychology, it was never on the table that psychopathology is related at all to biology. And so what I'm trying to say is, now we have advanced technologies that say that, yeah, behavior is largely based on those factors, but it's been ignored. So,
okay, really quickly, I want to switch to the intentionality piece.
Uh-huh.
Because that's interesting too.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I would want to ask you is, who is that really more so for? The person that's being harmed or the person that's harming?
Both. Both.
And what do you see the benefit and the cons in determining that?
Well, I was featured in a documentary about Ted Bundy. Okay. And Ted Bundy, it's really interesting because when he's being interviewed by this detective, he contradicts himself multiple times. First, he says, society deserves to be protected from people like me. And then he says, society is what caused me to be the way that I am because, porn made me kill and do all these things. And then he says, if you're going to look for cause and effect, you're not going to find it. I did what I did because I wanted to. And so why is this important? Because what if you're dating someone like Ted Bundy? Or what if that's your father? It's important to know that his intention is not to figure out how to stop what he's doing. His intention is to keep doing it and to convince everyone else that he's working on himself or he's trying or it wasn't his fault, depending on his audience. And so intentionality, if people say this poor guy had this adverse childhood and he was dissociating when he was kidnapping and killing all these women, well, what if he actually did that because he wanted to and he was fully conscious and cognizant of what he was doing? He just doesn't care about the consequences because his last victim was 12 years old and he, got angry at her for getting in the way of his, of getting caught. This is a very important problem for society to determine how intentional people are in their behaviors towards others. So I think it's something that should be extensively studied to determine how much of behavior that hurts others is related to conscious and deliberate intention versus unconscious defense mechanisms where people are feeling compelled and they can't control themselves. I think not only is that fascinating to research, but I think it's important to determine because it also determines culpability, punishment, consequences, rehabilitation. I come from a world where I've seen, not only in clinical practice, but it's been proven by people's behavior, that there is an intentionality to harmful behavior in some people, and that it's not necessarily that they're compensating for something. They happen to get rewarded from harming others rather than loving others. And I think it's important for people to know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's, I think severity is one thing. I think another thing is that people can get stuck in, and that actually can be like a trauma response in a way, and where people will get fixated on trying to understand the motivations of somebody when sometimes it doesn't matter. It's a waste of our time.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
So I guess, is this more so speaking from a research standpoint, or would this be for anybody to really think about intentionality of how harmful someone's actions are? Are we speaking more so from a big perspective of like murderers and criminals?
Well,
and
even that's a continuum. I think that professionals should, speak clinically and speak about research and, obviously verify their research. And if, and there's an educational component to that. But I think people in daily life should examine how satisfied they are in relationships, how safe they feel, and not necessarily try to go down this rabbit hole of is this person a narcissist or a psychopath or whatever, but maybe like I'm not liking the way I feel in this relationship, and maybe there's some pattern behavior that I'm just not going to accept long term, and so I'm going to honor myself and even in a way honor the other person by saying we're not going to move forward here because I'm not this isn't safe enough for me, right? I think it's important for people to be aware that some people, and this, this has been admitted.
How
I think
common is this?
how common is what?
That people are acting
With
with
intent to
malice,
harm?
with pure intention.
The majority of people don't act with malicious intent to harm, like the majority of people don't lie and deceive, for the purposes of exploiting others.
Do you have any figures?
It depends on the disorder. I mean, we talk about, general versus clinical populations. General population, when we talk about narcissism, for example, it's like there's a 1%, there's a 6%. But even that's like millions of people. So it's not like it's like an oddity or an anomaly. It's prevalent,
So I had a chance to look at your newer book. I'm curious, the whole CPTSD and borderline is something that like we've explored a lot on the podcast and something that's definitely my audience is really interested in. I'm curious, like what in your mind makes the distinction?
Well, not in my mind. I want to clarify what the research differentiates in those two disorders. Like, I honestly never speak from the laboratory of my mind and just decide what's real or not. I always have a source. There have been lots of proposals to try to like blend those two disorders as just under one like label and like a trauma disorder. The reason why those proposals are getting challenged and then kind of rejected is specifically because the difference between risk and causation, right? So, and this is actually even in, are you familiar with Marsha Linehan and her
I've
work
heard the
on?
name. I've heard the name.
So Marsha Linehan, she created DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. She developed it and she had her own struggles with this. The problem was she was going to treatment and not getting better because people weren't knowing how to treat what she was going through. And so she created dialectical behavioral therapy to help people who present with borderline features.
Interesting.
Yeah, but a lot of the research that she did speaks to this reality that trauma doesn't do anyone any favors, but individuals with certain traits and certain disorders, it's been pretty much proven that it does depend a lot on your biologically based temperament, how you respond to different adverse environments, right? Whereas complex PTSD is not necessarily dependent upon your temperament, if you will. I mean, you can be exposed to chronic cumulative trauma that can really be devastating and obviously cause all kinds of issues related to behavior, emotion dysregulation, things like that. But the difference between a trauma condition and a personality disorder, a lot of that has to do with the difference between something that's episodic in nature and something that's characteristic in nature, right? So again, with trauma, if somebody meets the criteria for a cluster B personality disorder, trauma's not doing them any favors, right? I mean, trauma's going to be, it's going to amplify, it's going to exacerbate a lot of things. However, what they've determined is when it comes to personality disorders, there is a biological component to it. There's biological underpinnings that make certain people more vulnerable to the development of that versus just a trauma disorder.
But more so in how are we differentiating between the two in a diagnosis? Because it does have a lot of overlapping symptoms.
The differences between like complex PTSD and diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder?
Yeah, because one thing it said, I'm looking at one of the sentences, you say, whereas trauma-related conditions are typically defined by avoidance, emotional numbing, and hyperarousal. I would say that is defining PTSD. Those are included in complex trauma, but it's not solely defined by those things.
How are you defining complex PTSD?
I mean, complex PTSD, when you look at the additional symptoms that it has in addition to the traditional PTSD symptoms, mm-hmm. is you have affect dysregulation. So that would include having rage responses, aggression, volatility. You then have the negative self-conception portion of it. So this is happening to you when you're developing your sense of self. And this comes from how it's recognized in the international standards, because complex PTSD is in whatever the equivalent of the DSM is over there.
The ICD.
It's recognized in there. So that contributes to the chronic shame and worthlessness. And then you have the relational disturbances. So fear of abandonment, attachment instability. And so complex trauma is not solely defined by avoidance, emotional numbing, and hyperarousal. Like, that is speaking to the traditional symptoms of PTSD that is typically episodic and is typically shock trauma or big T trauma.
So what causes complex PTSD?
Complex trauma.
Okay. So according to all of the clinical research, borderline personality disorder is not caused by complex trauma. So that's one of the main defining differences is mistaking risk for causation. Right. It's abundantly clear in diagnostic manuals and in clinical literature that there is a biological basis for personality disorders. So you can't call something complex PTSD if the causative factor is not trauma.
That's fine.
If the symptoms are superficially similar.
Yeah, I know. But what I'm saying is you're trying to say that they're different, but by you're saying because trauma is related to, like, this section is called CPTSD and BPD.
I'm not trying to say that they're different. I'm saying that they're distinctly different based on experts researching the causative factors of these disorders. I think you keep mistaking the message for the messenger in my writing.
Well, I mean, what am I supposed to take from you say, whereas trauma-related conditions are typically defined by avoidance, emotional numbing, and hyperarousal, BPD is more often characterized by retaliatory behavior, spite, and vengefulness, features mm-hmm. absence in individuals with complex trauma. That's not mm-hmm. an accurate statement.
It is an accurate statement.
No, you're that's saying, true yeah, of trauma, so, but not complex trauma.
You're saying that people with complex trauma have intentional retaliatory behaviors where they go in a vindictive and vengeful way to try to...
Yeah, I think absolutely it could be with complex trauma, for sure. And the other question that I was wondering too was in the next paragraph, I thought this was interesting, where you say, how are we defining retaliatory, whether it's like reactive or deliberate? Is it solely based upon what that person is reporting? Are we just like taking somebody's word at it?
Well, no, that's what people do when they diagnose trauma, is they take people's word for it. What I'm talking about are traits that actually can differentiate between reactive and proactive aggression.
So how does that work as far as like determining whether someone's actions are intentional versus reactive if we're looking at like the biological component? Is it seen like in a brain scan or traits, or how is it sussed out?
You can see things in neuroimaging findings. You can see things in genetic research. You can see things. If you're talking about traits, there are certain traits that predispose people to do things proactively versus reactively. Not everything is a defense mechanism. That's not true. People possess traits where they go out of their way to premeditate retaliation, and they do things to other people intentionally. This can be actually proven and differentiated between somebody who is reacting based on a threat response, where they're perceiving threat and they're reacting unprovoked, versus somebody who goes out of their way to intentionally try to harm someone for personal gain.
As far as like intentionality, like what are the main traits that we're looking at there?
Well, we look at behavior. So another thing we need to probably make a distinction of is when we're talking about psychotherapy and clinical treatment, mm-hmm. you are looking at the individual that you're sitting with right there, mm-hmm. and you're trying to understand their psychology. Mm-hmm. When we talk about traits and we talk about human behavior in general, we're talking about the general population,
right?
And so I want to make that distinction too. There are people who are antagonistic. They intentionally put people at odds with one another. They triangulate, they tell lies so that one person has a different narrative than another. And they're not doing this to protect themselves from anything. They're doing this to gain an advantage over people. And we've seen
this. How do we prove that?
How do we prove that they're not doing it?
Well, either way, I'm saying we can't prove one or the other.
Well, we can prove it to the degree that certain traits create certain reactions in nervous system reactivity and brain development. And we can actually measure that and see that in brain imaging and other types of tests, depending
on
how.
So what are those typically, those traits that go into play in sussing that out?
Pathological personality traits that would come into play would be antagonism, deception, manipulativeness, hostility, aggression, perseverance, which is basically doing the same thing over and over, regardless of the negative consequences and not learning from experience. Well, things like exhibitionism, things where we all have these traits. Traits aren't pathological if they fall into a certain range where they're not interfering with someone's personal functioning or interpersonal functioning, right? So it's not a matter of whether or not these exist only in certain people. We all have them. We all have aggression, right? We all have, you know, it's a matter of how far they operate on the continuum, right? So we can also do tests to test, you know, secretions in people, like what's being released during certain experiences. And then we can determine the motivation of whether or not that's a reward benefit or if that's a protective or reactive defense benefit.
Oh, interesting.
These are things that can be done too. So,
and is there like a gold standard in analyzing traits in a person? Would it be separate than like the gold standard of what a personality test would be or personality disorder test?
Personality disorder tests are difficult because, you know, oftentimes they rely on self-reports. So like you give people a series of questions, you know, how often do you A, B, and C? Mm-hmm. And then it's really up to them to choose what they believe about themselves. So self-reports are valid, but they're not always very
accurate
reliable. Mm-hmm. What you'd want to do, I mean, what would really be ideal and what has been done is you get, you know, an intake history of somebody where you get their entire history and you basically get to do sort of like a study on their observable behaviors that are not only verified by them, but verified by other people that are closest to them who experience them. And you start to measure the intensity, the frequency, the severity of how often these traits interfere in self-functioning and other functioning in four categories typically. So identity, goal direction, empathy, and intimacy. So those are intra and interpersonal functioning categories. And if we see, yeah, every time this person is interacting with somebody else, there's like severe impairment, that's where we can kind of start to measure the difference between a once in a while occasional behavior that's not very characteristic of someone and then something that is like pretty enduring and pervasive. Mm-hmm. And the more enduring and pervasive, you know, the more severe the personal and interpersonal difficulties. But the issue is, and we have to look at more than just psychotherapy, we have to look at evolutionary psychology, behavioral genetics, all kinds of factors that how do people behave in general, right? What are the mechanisms that cause behavior? It's not just trauma that causes people to treat other people.
I agree.
Yeah. And so I think another distinction that might help your audience is like, we're talking about traits, we're talking about behaviors, we're talking about the interaction of genes and environment. We're talking about the general population and not just the clinical population, because those two things are very distinct too. For example, people refer to narcissism culturally, related to community, related to clinical settings, and then related to just traits. There's such a thing as trait narcissism, right?
What does that mean? You mean like if they're just like narcissistic traits as opposed to having full-blown NPD?
Like traits that are part of the human condition, like just like introversion and extroversion
okay.
are traits.
Yeah.
Then there's grandiosity and there's, you know, those types of things too that some people have varying degrees of that they carry around with them. So they're not necessarily diagnosable with NPD, but they typically have a trait that's interfering in their life in pretty significant ways. That's kind of like the trait they use to operate in relationships, but they haven't necessarily sat down with a professional and received a diagnosis, right?
Is it true that there was like a shift? I don't know if it was like in the 80s or the 90s, but that there was a shift to make NPD more kind of solely focused around that grandiosity component?
Yes and no. So the history of NPD is that there was a diagnosable NPD in the 1980, in the DSM-3. The two earlier DSMs were heavily based on psychoanalytic interpretation. And because that's not really something we can measure, mm-hmm. you know, they decided, okay, well, we're going to eliminate things that are sort of conjecture and speculative and interpretive in favor of things that we can actually measure. The NPD and the DSM is heavily focused on the kind of overt grandiose narcissist. And now the latest edition is starting to incorporate the vulnerable narcissism and the associative features of that. But yeah, the DSM version of NPD is more related to that primary trait of grandiosity sort of fueling the engine, if that makes sense.
And what are your thoughts on that?
I think there are certainly people who fit the bill for that, where the grandiosity is the primary feature. And those individuals typically have high self-regard, like high self-esteem, high conviction that they are superior to others. Whereas there's other people who suffer from different afflictions where that's the opposite. You know, they have a compensatory, you know, way of going about the world. So they don't actually believe that they're great, but they want other people to believe that they're great. And they might actually be compensating from things that make them feel inferior.
Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking about like the situation with your grandmother. So your mother got most of the abuse, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How does that, like, because you were talking about, we're measuring how much damage is being done, how much it's conflicting with their life and the impact that they're having on other people. Mm-hmm. In certain cases where we do have, and, you know, I've encountered them myself, and even in friendship, where it only seems to be triggered or come out with certain people, how is that brought into the whole kind of diagnosis aspect of it? When it's only showing up in certain relationships or in certain dynamics?
I mean, there's a couple of ways to interpret that. One could be that they're choosing and selecting certain people to express that with, and then other people, they're somehow in control of how they're, you know, behaving with those people for whatever reason. Maybe it's to, you know, conceal something. Maybe it's just that they get along better with that other person, and maybe they're less activated by them for whatever reason. Another way to conceptualize it is oftentimes the people that you're in most conflict with are your attachment relationships, you know? So like your kids, your parents, and your significant others are the ones who typically bring out, you know, the highest amount of conflict. The only issue I see with that is there's parents who might meet the criteria for a personality disorder and they don't treat all of their kids in the same way. Like they might find a way to favor one child and or leave them alone completely, which isn't good. But then there's someone else that they kind of target as like the identified problem that they really give a hard time to and really abuse. So I think there's different ways to explain that. But typically when we talk about personality disorders versus trauma, we're talking about something that's characteristic of the individual, regardless of the environmental factors. Environment absolutely plays just as big of a role, right? So for example, if you have somebody who is naturally grandiose and they live in a culture that favors grandiosity, that's going to work out really well for them. They're not going to self-reflect and go, maybe I should stop being this way. They're going to think, see, I showed up as I am and everybody loves this, right? But there's also, you know, personality disorders are defined by the enduring patterns and pervasiveness. So it's not necessarily in all areas of their life that they are expressing this way of being. You know, somebody might thrive in work relationships and then not thrive so much in interpersonal relationships, or vice versa. They just can't seem to figure out a way to fit in a work environment, but their personal relationships aren't actually that bad. So I can't really give you a black or white answer of why that, how that is understood clinically, but those are some ideas.
Mm-hmm. Is there, because I know that part of what you express in your other book too, is in understanding this, it needs to then change the conversation or dictate the conversation as far as like how we're treating it. And I'm curious if there is, in your opinion, a large variation in how different personality disorders are, the methodology in treating them. Do you find that certain ones are more effective with certain modalities of treatment? Or do you find that since they're all kind of like in this cluster B, that similar modalities work best for all of them?
That's a good question. There are some modalities that across the board are used, and there's a difference between like management and treatment. So oftentimes the same the same techniques or methods can be used for managing certain behaviors, right? To contain things until treatment can kind of be more collaborative and people are safe. There's a couple of modalities that I mention in that book, like schema therapy, mentalization-based treatment, where I think with the exception, not according to me, according to the research, with the exception of antisocial personalities, those can be pretty effective in the other cluster Bs, depending again on severity of impairment. Obviously, dialectical behavioral therapy has been kind of hailed as the gold standard for BPD treatment and has been very successful.
Is that more from a, because I think that's interesting what you said about like the managing versus the treatment. Mm-hmm. Would you say for BPD with DBT, is that more from a treatment perspective or a management perspective?
I think the first step when you treat personality disorders is always management. You want to gauge, there's certain behaviors or risk factors that need to be contained enough in order for treatment to take hold. So for example, if somebody is really suffering from suicide risk, like that needs to be managed before you can start delving into the treatment protocol on a consistent basis. Or if a narcissistic individual is, you know, getting in frequent fights, physical fights, okay, well, that's going to interfere with treatment. So you got to get them to contain their, you know, aggression so that they can start participating. I think management is usually the first thing that you want to try to do prior to going into anything with more depth, but
it's like stabilization.
Yeah, essentially it's stabilization.
Almost like detox in a way. It's not, and, but you know what I mean, in some ways.
Well, yeah. And I mean, for, that's a great analogy. For the record too, like when you're sitting across from somebody in, as a therapist, when you're sitting across from somebody in treatment, you're not thinking to yourself like, oh my gosh, this person's a grandiose narcissist or whatever. You're looking at how to help them make sense of what they're, you know, going through and how to make their life better, which oftentimes involves interpersonal conflict, right? When you're talking about research from the perspective of how humans just behave since the beginning of time, that's a completely different like conversation that you're having. You're just kind of looking at statistics, you're looking at research, you're looking at, okay, this trait tends to operate, you know, in individuals who we describe as narcissists, right? So I just want to make that clear too. There's a distinction between conversations we have between like treatment and conversation. Your cat is so cute.
One's behind me too. I'm sitting on the edge of my chair because the other one's sitting behind me.
Anyway, I just wanted to make that clear too, that you have to have completely different conversations about things depending on if you're treating it, managing it, or if you're just talking about, you know, talking about it in a general way of, you know, how it operates in society, how it operates on a broader scale.
What about thoughts on medication for management? Can it be helpful?
So, I mean, again, you're asking such good questions. That depends. A lot of the research that goes into personality disorders, because we're talking more of like characteristic ways of being, it's not necessarily something that can be, you know, mitigated with like a medication. That's not to say that if you give somebody enough medication, it's not going to change them. Or certain antidepressants in people with comorbid, you know, mood struggles like depression and anxiety, which narcissists have, people with BPD, that can mitigate some of those symptoms related to the anxiety or the depression that they're suffering from. But it's not going to change their personality to be on medication. Yeah. I think personality changes versus changing trauma symptoms. One of the main things is, if there's something that's like deficient in someone, let's say someone has a lack of empathy, we can argue till we're blue in the face whether or not they lost their empathy from trauma or if they just were born with a deficit. But the bottom line is they need empathy, right? Mm-hmm. So when we treat personality disorders, we're looking for a way to almost install something that's not there. And so you do that through figuring out, you know, what's the mechanism that's going to get this person to believe it's in their best self-interest to have more empathy. And you have to sort of perform like an emotional surgery in a way. Like this is something that needs to be put into you that you don't have naturally for whatever reason. So it's a lot different than treating, I mean, trauma is relevant to that, but the interventions aren't trauma interventions for something like that. It's more like a structuring of something, of a self that isn't there and that needs to be there, kind of a thing.
And have you noticed any sort of variables in when you've been, you know, working with people one-on-one on what might make them more receptive to treatment?
Depends on what they're struggling with and what the disorder is, but typically, like, somebody who has a difficult time collaborating with other people and taking advice from other people or taking suggestions from other people, they need to be on board with the fact that that's like this well, that this is something that's going to be useful for them. There's utility in it rather than it just being something that they're told to do. It's, well, this is in your best self-interest to adopt this, because if you do adopt it, then your life is going to get better. And so you kind of, they need to get on board with that. And
tell it, baby.
It's difficult. It's difficult to, you know, find a way for some people to make it seem like they're not feeling talked down to or lectured or whatever, and that this is actually something that would benefit them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In like CBT, for example, in kids, they've done pre and post neuroimaging on kids in therapy with CBT that had some of these kind of traits that are not making life easy for them. You know, they're having trouble with peers and trouble at school. And they've actually done post neuroimaging scans after CBT treatment, and the structure and function of the brain has drastically changed in their favor, where they're less antagonistic, they're less combative, they're less oppositional. And then they realize, wow, this is actually getting me what I want. I'm getting friends. I'm not getting sent to the office every 5 minutes. So I think early prevention and detection and early intervention is, you know, also something that's very promising.
Because that's, I mean, I'm assuming that's speaking to like neuroplasticity of kids' brains.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. Well, great. Well, so what else are you going to be working on? You're rewriting your other book. Do you have other ones that are in the works as well?
I'm working on co-authoring a couple of workbooks just for people to kind of develop, formulate like a sense of self and an identity after difficult situations of all kinds, just kind of more like self-help kind of material. So those will be coming out probably next year, or later this year. Yeah, that's pretty much
just
it.
Just cranking them out.
Trying.
Well, I really appreciate it. This will be good. I can't wait for people to hear it. People are wanting to hear this. So,
can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
I think you reached out to me in early December. Is there anything that you like about my work that we didn't cover?
In the same way that I almost push back with the trauma stuff, I also am like of the viewpoint of how we make everything. Like, I feel like it has become such an excuse as well. Mm. Like for people to just throw up the trauma about everything. And the same thing with narcissism. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that I push back, I think that this is so important because I feel like people have just started to really use it as an excuse.
Yeah.
Like a ton.
Yeah.
And so that's like the part of it where I feel like that aspect of, we just have a society of people who just make excuses.
Yeah.
So I really respect and think that that part of the conversation is so important, because my biggest thing is it's all about accountability,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like owning our shit. And I just think that people do use trauma. I mean, people are like saying, I have to call it a work because I moved this weekend and I have trauma from it. It's like, it really just cheapens the brand.
I agree. I think ultimately that's some of the stuff that I say might seem a little too emphatic, or like you mentioned in our first interview about like you were kind of concerned that there was like a downplaying. I think one of the reasons why I highlighted it so much is because it's not really being talked about as much as I would like, this idea of what you just described. So rather than downplaying it, I certainly want to draw attention to the fact that what you just said, it's being used oftentimes as like an excuse that's not necessarily. Yeah.
And I just, I mean, the thing that I just have pushed back on is I just think it's, we need to be really careful on how we're describing like complex trauma. But at the same time, I think it is a word that is being weaponized and overused. And I think we're really seeing it play out in society in not a good way. So I really, that's what drew me to your book initially. So
cool.
Well, thanks, Peter. Thank you for having me. This was great.
Thanks a lot. Let it all go. What's making you slow now? Let it go.